From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we look at Governor Evers' plan to expand Medicaid access and how it could impact Wisconsinites.
The governor's administration has estimated that expanding the program would cover an additional 82,000 people through Medicaid.
Later, we set the stage for our week-long Project Milwaukee series on the challenges of providing clean, safe drinking water in the region.
But if you think there are challenges now, think back to the early days of Milwaukee.
Back in those days, people didn't know how to treat sewage, you know, human and animal waste. So after they kind of put the current to sleep in the Milwaukee River by docking and dredging, on a hot day in the summer months, all that stuff would just sit there and cook. So you had just an unbearable stench.
And we'll hear the story of a Wisconsin woman who has run across the country and inspired others to do the same. Lake Effect is next, after the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Since the Affordable Care Act was passed in 2010, states have had the option to expand access to Medicaid through federal funds. Wisconsin is among a minority of states that didn't accept these funds, which extends Medicaid access to people living just above the federal poverty line.
Governor Evers included Medicaid expansion in his most recent budget, but the proposal faces an uncertain future. Although Democrats have long supported the idea, some Republicans are fervently against expansion, while others are looking for compromise.
Sean Kirkby is the assistant editor of Wisconsin Health News, an online publication that covers statewide health care news. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers and starts by explaining the timeline of Wisconsin's debate over expanding access to Medicaid.
The Affordable Care Act allowed states to expand Medicaid to childless adults up to 130% of the federal poverty level, which is about $17,000 a year now. And it did so by offering an enhanced federal funding for states that did so. Wisconsin did a different approach. It decided to align the Medicaid program with the private market in the state. And so lawmakers with Governor Scott Walker created a program where the eligibility for Medicaid ends at 100% of the federal poverty level, which is about $12,000 a year. People who make less than that are covered through BadgerCare, which is the state's name for Medicaid. And people who make more of that have to buy their coverage through the individual market or healthcare.gov. And the thinking behind that was that the people who would be buying the coverage would have access to subsidies underneath the Affordable Care Act, advanced premium tax credits that would really lower the price of insurance for them. That was kind of the current state of things, and there wasn't a lot of push underneath Governor Walker to take the federal funding available under the Affordable Care Act to expand the program. That changed with Governor Tony Evers, who has put forward a plan that would expand Medicaid to 138% of the federal poverty level, so that's $17,000 amount, and take the money that the state would see by taking the federal funding, which is more than the state currently sees through the program, and reinvesting the state dollars into the state's healthcare system.
So if we expand Medicaid in Wisconsin, who is that picking up? How many people who are in that kind of block between, you know, 100% of the federal poverty rate versus 130%, how many of them are uninsured right now?
So the governor's administration has estimated that expanding the program would cover an additional 82,000 people through Medicaid. Now, because of the way that it's structured now, about 40,000 of those people have private insurance and have bought their coverage through the Affordable Care Act. And so that leaves about the other half, the other 40,000, without insurance right now.
Okay. So we'd be looking at insuring an additional 40,000 people and possibly moving around 40,000 people off of these private insurance policies?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. What has Governor Evers specifically put forward in his proposal in expanding Medicaid?
So the governor has proposed expanding to 130%, covering those 82,000 people. And that would, because of the higher amount of money that you receive from the federal government, He estimates the state could save around $325 million in just state money alone. And the budget takes that money and it kind of reinvests it in the healthcare system and also uses it to draw down more federal dollars from the federal government through these matches and this complicated sort of Medicaid policy stuff. So they estimate that they'd be able to take that money and pull down $1.6 billion, with a B, dollars in federal money to help invest in all these different types of initiatives that kind of address some healthcare issues in the state. So he puts money towards dental care. He would put money towards increasing hospital rates. There's some mental health initiatives that are also within the budget, a package that's also targeting women and infant health in the state. And all of those things are predicated on accepting the federal funding and expanding Medicaid.
So, you know, you mentioned a lot of numbers there, and there right now are these dueling studies over either the beneficial or the detrimental impact of expanding access to Medicaid. Do those numbers come from either of those reports, the numbers coming out of the Evers administration, or have they been checked by these reports?
Those numbers are from Evers administration, and they're just a budget proposal itself. The reports take a little bit of a different approach and looking and seeing how Medicaid expansion would affect the state at large. And so there have been two reports that have come out in recent months from Wisconsin groups looking at Medicaid expansion. The first came out in February from the Conservative Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty and the Center for Research on the Wisconsin Economy at the University of Wisconsin. And basically what they looked at was what taking those federal dollars could mean for the state's private insurance market. Medicaid typically pays less than what private insurance does. And that's led some people to suggest and some providers to suggest that there's a cost shift where the people who are on private insurance pay more to make up for the gap in Medicaid reimbursement. And so that report argues that while we would see a state savings in terms of state money, taxpayer money, you would see a net cost of around $600 million per year after you factor in what providers have to do to make up for low Medicaid rates. And that report, it didn't look at expansion's impacts on health, whether or not it had positive or negative impacts on that. And it was critiqued by healthcare advocates in the state for not doing that. And they also got some significant blowback from some economists in the journal Sentinel and other places. And just earlier in this month, in April, the same center that was involved with releasing that report put out a different report with different economists at the University of Wisconsin. And they took a different approach at accounting for what impact Medicaid expansion could have on uncompensated care costs. So these are costs that are essentially when people who do not have insurance and can't afford the care, hospitals will sometimes write off that amount of money as charity care or bad debt. So they took a look at what Medicaid expansion could have on hospital uncompensated care costs. And they estimated that it could actually save up to $100 million a year and that there would actually be a net positive benefit from taking this money. And they also dispute the earlier study as well.
So we have these dueling proposals going back and forth. And on the side of that, we have legislators who are also kind of dueling over whether or not Medicaid expansion is ultimately beneficial for the state. What are legislators saying on both sides of the aisle?
The Democrats have been pushing for Medicaid expansion for a very long time. And so they're all for Governor Evers' budget on this. The Republicans have long opposed Medicaid expansion, but you're beginning to sort of see a few Republicans come forward and talk about potentially looking for some sort of compromise. We have like legislative panels occasionally, and at one of these we had Representative Dale Coinga, who is a Republican from Brookfield, and he talked about that he was, you know, personally not opposed to Medicaid expansion. And there have been other Republicans, Senator Patrick Teston, who chairs the Senate Health Committee and is a Republican from Stevens Point, has talked about potentially looking for a compromise model. And Senator Alberta Darling, Republican, who is the co-chair of the Joint Finance Committee and is from River Hills, has talked about potentially looking at Utah, which has taken a sort of similar path to Wisconsin in terms of covering people up to 100% of the federal poverty level to that 12,000. So those are, we're beginning to hear a little bit of interest in a potential compromise, but we also still hear from some Republican leaders who are very much against this still. You know, just this week, the Associated Press reporter Scott Bauer did a story about some Republicans looking for compromise. And Assembly Speaker Robin Voss tweeted back in response to that, hashtag never. So there's a lot of concern among Republicans about shifting people from private coverage to public coverage, that they do not want to see those 40,000 people who now have private coverage be moved to a public program. So we'll have to see, you know, who kind of goes forward on this.
You know, you mentioned Utah, and when you look at Medicaid expansion throughout the country, it hasn't just been Democratic states, Democrat-run states, but rather Republican and Democrat-run states. When we compare what Governor Evers is proposing in his budget legislation to these Republican states that have expanded Medicaid, how does it stack up?
So a lot of this, it depends a lot on the state that you're looking at. Most states, I believe, have gone and done the Medicaid expansion fully through the Affordable Care Act all the way up to 138%. You see a few states like Arkansas trying to do these different approaches in terms of having, you know, the private option. A few other states that have received approval earlier have used premiums and work requirements as kind of the compromise to get Republicans on board. That was the case in Indiana. And that is, it's a little bit of a different conversation because we already have those approved in Wisconsin and are set to implement them later this year. So I'm not sure if that would necessarily be an avenue for, you know, compromise in terms of that since we already have those. But that's kind of the lay of the land, is that a lot of states have expanded all the way underneath the Affordable Care Act, and then there are a few sort of variations, usually around work requirements in the states that were more conservative-led.
And it seems like a lot of those states, or at least some of those states, are now facing judicial backlash to some extent where their work requirements are being found unconstitutional.
Yeah, and so that's happened in Kentucky and Arkansas. And one thing that sort of comes up with that is that the work requirements, they vary considerably from state to state. And so in terms of like Wisconsin's work requirements, basically it affects, you know, people who don't have kids in the program. And it kicks in that you lose coverage after 4 years of not working, so 48 consecutive months. And this isn't in effect yet. It'll go into likely go into effect later this year. Other states, though, they're a lot more stricter. And in Arkansas, for instance, when those requirements went into effect, about 18,000 people or so, I believe, the last I checked, and that could be a little bit different now, have lost their coverage. And people aren't sure why they lost their coverage, but it is something that happened after these work requirements went into effect.
I guess we'll see where the proposal goes and whether or not it makes it through the legislature. But Sean Kirkby, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work with me.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Sean Kirkby is the assistant editor of Wisconsin Health News, an online publication that covers statewide health news. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and there is more information at WUWM.com.
We will take a quick break now and then preview our latest Project Milwaukee series, Great Lakes, Troubled Waters, when Lake Effect continues in a moment from Milwaukee's NPR. Back now with more of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. WUWM's latest Project Milwaukee series will kick off Monday and run all week. This time, the collaborative effort will explore something none of us can live without: water. Project Milwaukee Great Lakes Troubled Waters will delve into a variety of issues surrounding the challenges in ensuring a clean and safe water supply in a place that's adjacent to an enormous body of fresh water.
For a preview of the series, we're joined in the studio by two people who have helped shape the coverage: LaToya Dennis from the WUWM News Team and Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. They are the executive producers of Project Milwaukee. Welcome to you both.
Hi there.
Hi.
So why tackle this issue now?
You know, so many people are talking about water these days that it seems fitting. Governor Evers has declared this the year of clean drinking water across the state, and people are concerned about lead, but also the impact that firm runoff is having on water sources. Now, I didn't live in Milwaukee in the early 1990s, but I'm familiar with the crypto outbreak. And since then, public officials here have been telling Milwaukeeans that they have the best water in the country. And yet, so many people here are afraid to drink from their tap or swim in local rivers. So I can't really think of a better time or a better topic.
Well, so let's get back to Governor Evers for just a second here. What does it mean for it to be the year of clean drinking water? And what about just kind of clean water in general?
Well, when it comes to clean drinking water, one of the people we spoke with is Todd Ames. He's the Assistant Deputy Secretary for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and he's a water guy. The DNR is in charge of ensuring clean water.
Unfortunately, thanks to a wide variety of reasons from a wide variety of sources in a wide variety of places in this state, we currently, unfortunately, have tens of thousands of people that are no longer confident that they can turn on the tap and drink the water.
Now, Ames says there are four key areas that the DNR is looking at, and these include legacy contaminants from industrial sites. There's lead, well contamination from runoff, and PFAS contamination, which is found in virtually everything from packaging to cosmetics, firefighting foam to waterproof clothing. You know, the list can go on and on here. But throughout the week, we will be delving more deeply into many of those concerns, and we'll also be speaking with a lot of Milwaukee leaders about this.
So when it comes to the health of Wisconsin's water sources, mainly those in the greater Milwaukee area, as we're going to be covering, what's the verdict?
So it's a little tricky because there's not, say, you know, like a report card that like Michigan gets for an overall health grading system. There's EPA reports on things like lake-wide action and management plans. There's habitat and land use, zooplankton levels, things like that. And Great Lakes Areas of Concerns, or AOCs. And these include sources of pollution, there's boundaries, and restoration, of course. But when we look at water, specifically divided into lakes, rivers, and wetlands, there's some improvement, but also legislation that wants to deregulate these protections. There is the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative of 2009, which still continues today to fund projects that impact Lake Michigan drainage, wildlife habitat, and water quality, as well as working on reducing contaminations from rivers and floodplains.
When it comes to rivers, you know, the Milwaukee, the Menominee, and the Kinnekinnick rivers all have long histories of pollution from industries that dump toxic waste and polluted runoff from farms and cities. And while the rivers are cleaner than they used to be, we even had an open swim in the Milwaukee River last year, ultimately the clean water access that rivers should be fishable, swimmable, and drinkable, and we're obviously not there yet. Now, one major recent concern is runoff, both from urban and agricultural areas. For example, the Uleo Creek is a tributary of the Milwaukee River in Ozaukee County. Cheryl Nin is with the Milwaukee Riverkeeper. She points to the lack of vegetation along riverways, creating the opportunity for large amounts of sediment to alter the water.
Sediment's a huge issue in this watershed, and also kind of everything that's bound to the sediment. And so in a lot of cases, that's fertilizers, again, coming from ag, but also maybe coming from people's backyards. Phosphorus is a big issue in this watershed. And also bacteria.
So next week, Project Milwaukee will cover a lot of territory when it comes to the health of water, including a live lake effect. Tell us a little bit more about that event.
Well, on Tuesday, May 7th, you all should mark your calendars right now as to not forget.
It is on my calendar.
I hope so. Right. We're running it.
We'll be taking Lake Effect on the road to the Cooperage and the Harbor District, which is perfect because it's right on the water and we are obviously talking about water. This Lake Effect will focus on emergency emerging threats to our waterways, in addition to water policy, community health impact, and business and innovation with a number of experts in these fields.
Now, Mitch, you and I know that we run 10 to 11 every day, and since this is a live broadcast, doors will open at 9:30 for the public, and the show will start right at 10 to 11. It's a free event, but we're asking that people RSVP at WUWM.com. And if the topic isn't engaging enough, we'll also incite you and provide you with a light breakfast like pastries and coffees and the like.
Well, and so two things going on here. One is that people get to see live radio being made, and the other is they'll get a lot more information and a lot more understanding of the state of water here.
Yeah, we're hoping they'll leave the doors and look at the river and the harbor right there in a very different way.
Yeah.
All right. Well, LaToya and Audrey, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Audrey Nowakowski and LaToya Dennis are executive producers of our Project Milwaukee series, which will run all next week.
We will flash back to our relationship with water at the turn of the last century when Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. As we heard before the break, WUWM's latest Project Milwaukee series, which runs all next week, will focus on the challenges of ensuring a clean and safe water supply in the Milwaukee area. But while some of the details are specific to the 21st century, the challenges are nothing new.
Historian John Gerda points out that water has played an instrumental role in Milwaukee since before the city was even called Milwaukee. We spoke with him last summer about his 2018 book called Milwaukee, A City Built on Water. John Gerda, welcome back to Lake Effect.
Glad to be here, Mitch.
So is this the 20th book for you?
22nd.
22nd book.
Who'd have guessed?
It's a lot of books.
It is.
With all those books under your belt, what were the aspects to Milwaukee's water history that you were the least familiar with going into this project?
I think the role the river had played in the early years was obviously crucial, and I knew that, and did a book called Making Milwaukee that was kind of a general history. And the fact that we have the best natural harbor on Lake Michigan, the Western Shore, is why we're here. So that was new news, or that was old news to me. But in terms of looking at water, looking at the history of the city from a watery lens, as the society puts it, I think one of the big sort of revelations was how different the Milwaukee River was above and below the North Avenue Dam. I describe it as sort of Jekyll and Hyde. And I knew about the pollution below. I knew about the recreation above. But the extent of both was something that was a bit surprising.
Well, and I want to get into that in just a couple minutes. But I think what I love about this book, when you title it Milwaukee, A City Built on Water, is that you're speaking both literally and metaphorically.
It works on a whole lot of levels. You know, the fact that most of Milwaukee's downtown was underwater is certainly a factor. Menominee Valley, much of Bayview, all the Third Ward, much of Walker's Point. You know, that was all very, very boggy real estate, and in some cases, many cases, pretty much underwater 12 months of the year. So all the landfill activities that took place here are a huge part of the present landscape. All Lincoln Memorial Drive, that's all landfill as well. So it works literally, but in terms of the formative role water had on Milwaukee's history, begins with the harbor, and then it moves on to the river, and the river provides both transportation and power. The North Avenue Dam was intended as kind of a headwater for a canal, but it became instead, after that was aborted, it became a mill race. So that was Milwaukee's first industrial district, and then it became recreation. So on all those levels, water really has played a really very formative role in Milwaukee's history.
So let's talk about the idea of building a canal. This came along about the time that the country was kind of canal crazy, right?
Yeah, 1825 is when the Erie Canal opens across upstate New York, as you know, your old home turf. And that was hugely successful, and it touched off an epidemic of canal building around the country. Ohio was a very big state. Byron Kilbourn was one of the surveyors on the Ohio canals. And when he came here back in 1834, to him it was a no-brainer. You know, you have his west side. This was not a Milwaukee project. This was a Byron Kilbourn project. You'd have this canal that would have linked his west side with Rock River at Fort Atkinson and thereby the the Illinois there by the Mississippi. So he really envisioned, you know, his side of this, of town as being kind of the point of entry to the Trans-Mississippi West, a very big deal. He had a habit of making enemies. He was not a guy who played well with others, and that canal was aborted after he finished a mile and a quarter. But the plan B was to have this industrial district, you know, that was powered by the mill race.
Well, right. There were flour mills.
Textile mills a little bit farther north. But flour was the main event. A little later, there were tanneries. So, and you think about that in the present context, the area around Brady Street, they call that East Village sometimes. It's the old Polish neighborhood around St. Hedwig's Church there in Humboldt and Brady. And it's hard to imagine today, but that was once an outlier neighborhood that was separated from downtown Milwaukee by open land. And the reason they located out there back in the 1870s was because they could walk to work in those jobs along the Milwaukee and Rock River Canal.
There were also mills out on the Menominee River, weren't there?
There were, especially around Wauwatosa. Hart's Mills is the first name of Wauwatosa, so that's where that began, right in the heart of the village. So it began right there. Water power is the reason that that we have a Wauwatosa today.
You were talking a few minutes ago about this these sort of two versions of the Milwaukee River, both upstream and downstream of the North Avenue Dam, and mm-hmm. how really defined those two areas were.
They certainly were. Downstream, as Milwaukee became a much larger city, you had both human waste and these tons of animal waste that would plop onto Milwaukee streets every hour of every day.
Plop being a wonderful verb there.
So back in those days, people didn't know how to treat sewage, you know, the kind of human and animal waste. So after they had kind of put the current to sleep in the Milwaukee River by docking and dredging, on a hot day in the summer months, all that stuff would just sit there and cook. So you had just an unbearable stench. There was a quote I can recall from 1881 described the Milwaukee River as a currentless and yellowish murky stream with water like oil and an odor combined of the effluvia of 100 sewers. And there are two pages in the book that are nothing but descriptions, no sort of eyewitness accounts or I think nose witness accounts of what it was like in the Milwaukee River. And I could have chosen another dozen. No, they were just abundant. And the editors at the Historical Society Press said, maybe that's too many. I said, no, that's one of the strongest points of the book. So it really was a cesspool. And the term the Sentinel used in one headline was one vast sewer. So they knew what they were doing. They knew precisely what they were doing. And then what happened was above the North Avenue Dam, where until development kind of extended up that far, there was not that much of a human footprint. You know, it remained more farmland. So that was much, much cleaner. And beginning back in the later 1800s, you have swimming schools and canoe clubs and amusement parks and water slides and beer gardens.
I'm fascinated by the amusement park. What is it? Wonderland looked like it was a massive complex.
Big deal. Roller coasters, carousels, all kinds of arcades, and it's still there. The park is still there, but now it's called Hubbard Park. Much quieter.
There was a name. I'm trying to remember what it was. The name of one of the rides at Wonderland.
It's called the human washing machine, something.
That's exactly.
It was sort of people would dive from this tower. The other one was down there a little bit farther south in the river was Shoot the Chutes. It was a water slide. You know, just on the east side of the river at around the North Avenue Bridge, and it opened back in 1896, and it was essentially a water toboggan, and there is reason to say that Wisconsin's first water park was the Upper Milwaukee River. No, that's where people went. And it's, again, hard for us to imagine today in 2018, but back in those days, there was no air conditioning and people had one-day weekends. So you had to be, you know, you had to be some respite, you know, some means of getting outdoors and enjoying at least the hint of a cooling breeze, you know, instead of being stifling inside. So the fact that the Milwaukee River was within walking distance for thousands of people was really important.
To say nothing of the fact that it was also an enormous skating rink in the winter.
That's right. Yeah, it was four-season fun. When the ice was good, when you had a freeze before you had a lot of snow and it was easy to skate, there were winter carnivals around Gordon Park, and there's a great photo in the book of skaters probably from around the vantage of the North Avenue Dam, for as far as the eye can see, it is covered with skaters. So our ancestors were pretty intrepid. I think sometimes we think they were, you know, sort of a whole different cut from what we are. They also didn't have video games and TV and cell phones, so there were fewer temptations, you know, to stay indoors.
Selfies were possible, but it took much longer.
much longer.
So that's kind of a glimpse of the history of the rivers. Let's talk for a minute about the lakefront. You mentioned that Milwaukee has the deepest natural harbor on this side, the west side of the lake. But how about a more fundamental question? If the lakefront was so boggy at the time that downtown was developing, why didn't downtown just develop further inland?
It probably should have developed closer to where it is, where the waterfront is. Jones Island was the point of entry to Milwaukee Harbor. And even though that was wet, the important thing was access. You could fill land in. No, that was an engineering problem that you could solve in time. The important thing was access. So the fact that downtown developed where it did, Josette and Solomon Juneau put their trading post in Water, Wisconsin back in 1825. That was the first dry ground above the mouth of the Milwaukee River, and that's why downtown developed on that east-west axis. Byron Kilburn was farther north. He was up around 3rd and Juneau, ironically, then called Chestnut Street. No, they didn't get along especially well. So you have those two settlements on the east and west sides, and because Juneau had his home there in Water, Wisconsin, that became the axis of downtown. But because Walker was down there on the south side, he was closer to Milwaukee's front door, downtown probably should have developed there. And a number of reasons he didn't, the most serious being someone jumped his claim, and it took him 7 years before he could sell lots with clear title. If that had not been the case, your studios might be down in Walker's Point instead of on water in Wisconsin.
Water in Wisconsin, right. Well, and we should note that this was not a unique issue in Milwaukee. I mean, there were many cities. If I remember correctly, much of downtown Boston was backfill.
Yeah, much of New York. I mean, Wall Street, well, there was a wall. You know? So, and Chicago. They were boggier than we were. And when they built the city the first time, the buildings would, you know, they talked about the streams of liquid fill from the streets because the water table was so high. So they actually jacked up those buildings, filled in the land, and moved these hotels around Chicago's loop. So no, this was by no means a unique phenomenon, but it certainly gives credence to the idea of Milwaukee being built on water.
At what point does Milwaukee realize that there is something? I mean, you said they knew what they were doing when they were dumping sewage into the Milwaukee River, but at what point do they realize that they can do something about this?
Not until the teens of the last century. And I think the thinking was the old line, you know, the solution to pollution is dilution. You know, so it's filthy, but if you dilute it enough, it becomes less harmful. There was no technology. Around the turn of the 20th century, there were proposals to kind of pipe it out to the edge of town and landfill it, basically, which would have been an engineering kind of a marvel, you know, to move that much liquid kind of out that far. And I suppose ultimately could have been fertilizer. But what happened, the real breakthrough was there was an English inventor who'd discovered that if you kind of activated the bacteria in the sewage sludge, it would dissolve or digest the toxins, the biotoxins, something like 90%. So Milwaukee said, oh, look at this. And Milwaukee became, after being kind of behind the pack, became a leader of the pack. In 1925, we built that first sewage treatment plant on Jones Island, still there in much more modern form. And that was by far the largest activated sludge plant in the entire world. And people would come from around the world just to see how it operated. So our sludge didn't just stand around. Our sludge was activated.
That could have been the city's slogan. John Goerde, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Mitch.
Historian John Goerter is the author of 22 books, including last year's Milwaukee, A City Built on Water. You can find a list of his upcoming events and how to find his books from a link at WUWM.com. And don't forget to tune in to our latest Project Milwaukee series on water, which is all next week on Lake Effect and WUWM News.
We will take one last break and then learn the story of a Wisconsin woman who has run across the country and inspired others to share her efforts. We'll be back right after this on Milwaukee's NPR.
We are back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. It is quite an accomplishment to run a marathon, an accomplishment that I cannot claim, but my co-host here can.
Yes, indeed. Well, actually, that was two marathons, but even that pales by comparison with the achievement of Ashley Schneider. Just over 9 years ago, Schneider successfully became one of just a handful of women to run across the entire United States.
But the reason she did it and what the effort has evolved into are even more important than that first run. We'll listen back to part of our 2012 interview with her in a few minutes. But first, Schneider's work is the subject of an article in the May issue of Milwaukee Magazine. We're joined in the studio by writer Dan Simmons. Welcome back to the show.
Good to be here. Thanks, Mitch.
Bring us back to that first effort in 2010. What spurred her to run across the country that first time?
So she had kind of a dream job right out of college at UWL. She was running fitness programs on a cruise ship.
nice work if you can get it. Yeah.
Yes. So she was teaching people on cruise ships to rock climb and surf, as I recall, and meeting a lot of people from all over the world who kind of had this common fascination with her country and a real passion for exploring it, which kind of awakened her in her this epiphany that, hey, I should explore my own country since everyone else in the world wants to explore it so much. You know, why not? I actually, you know, that's my home. And she had this epiphany that she should run across the country. What better way to see the country than, you know, on foot? And further, that she should do so as a fundraiser for multiple sclerosis, which is a very dear cause to her because she watched her mom suffer through it her entire childhood.
So this first effort itself made a splash, I gather, though it didn't quite hit its fundraising goal. What went right and what didn't go quite as right in that first effort?
The running went spectacularly right,
right,
shockingly.
Like two blisters, right, the whole time.
And a short bout of heat exhaustion. So, you know, which defines a lot of people's, you know, weekend running jaunt. She went across the country and was virtually unscathed by the effort. She put a lot of training into it, but still the best laid plans often, you know, go awry. Not for her. She got across the country, no problem, but she finished in New York City after starting in San Francisco at the Golden Gate Bridge and just felt this odd emptiness.
And she had become, she was what, only the 16th woman ever to do this?
She was, yeah.
So you say she kind of had this emptiness after that first run was over. So how did that first experience evolve in subsequent years to what MS Run the US became?
So she had this fundraising goal of $500,000. She didn't reach it, and she just felt like a failure, which is a strange feeling for someone who has just run across the country. But that was her real driving passion for this project. She didn't meet it. And in the process of running across the country, again, she met a lot of people who said, man, I wish I could do that. And so these two ideas formed into this nonprofit for her. What if I give people across the country an opportunity to do a leg of this? Not the entire thing, but, you know, 6 days of it. And kind of spread the wealth in terms of fundraising. So she hatched this idea to form a nonprofit, which has become MS Run the U.S., and it's in its, I think it's eighth running now.
Right, and so they choose more than a dozen runners to each run basically a marathon a day for 6 days. How do they choose who gets to do this?
So there's a pretty rigorous screening process, as I understand. I mean, you have to prove, number one, that you're up for this challenge, which more people are than you would imagine. It seems like everyone Ashley meets, in my experience with her, she views as having the potential to do this. So it's not like you have to have done this before or be some kind of crazy ultramarathoner. You know, she takes people who want to do it and coaches them up, gives them the training that is going to help them do this. But then you also have to show a commitment to this cause and a commitment that is going to extend to fundraising for this cause. So those are the criteria.
Right. They have to meet a benchmark. Is that right? Do they have to raise something like $10,000?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, they don't have to raise that before they're accepted, but they have to show an ability and willingness to do so.
Well, and you spoke with one of the runners who conveniently for this story lives in Wauwatosa. What was Annapurna's connection to this cause?
Again, her mom had MS, and so she – and her mom had been a runner in her early years, and so MS obviously disqualified her from any physical activity like that. And so it was sort of a natural fit for her as well. And like Ashley, she came into this a pretty casual runner and became quite an obsessive.
Well, and so we talk about raising money for MS, but what do you know about the sorts of things the nearly $1.5 million, I guess, at this point, that they've raised has helped fund?
It's kind of two prongs, research and then needs as they arise for people with MS.
So there's some very specific needs, right?
Exactly. So a man down in, I believe it was Kenosha, needed a lift for his van, so he could get around and go enjoy life.
And so these are, presumably people apply to receive funds through the program and they find them?
They do, but they're also connected with other MS nonprofits throughout the country who sometimes refer cases like his to them.
Well, so you are a runner, correct?
Once a runner.
Yeah. So
still sort of a runner.
Is this something you could even conceive of doing?
Once I talked to Ashley, yes.
What is it about her? What is her strength that really lets her be such an ideal person to get people through this?
She's very even keeled. She's not, a real rah-rah type, and she's not a downer. She just has this kind of ability to instill the same quiet confidence that she has in other people.
So back to the initial question is, could you see yourself taking this on someday?
My 24-year-old self, yes. 42-year-old self, not so much. Not that it's not possible. It just takes an incredible commitment of time that currently in my life that spent chasing around as an almost 6-year-old. So that's kind of my marathon.
I was just going to say, it's a marathon itself. Well, Dan Simmons, thank you so much for sharing the story with us.
Okay, great to be here. Thanks, Mitch.
Writer Dan Simmons is a frequent contributor to Milwaukee Magazine. His article on Ashley Schneider and her MS Run the U.S. organization is in the May issue.
We spoke with Ashley Schneider back when she was Ashley Cumlin back in 2012 about her first run across the United States and what she hoped her effort would become. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
What does running and long-distance running and extremely long-distance running have to do with MS? Why is this your tool, if that's the right word?
I guess it's my tool because it's something that – it's the tool that God gave me. Fitness and running are two things that are very important to me. And they come – I wouldn't say naturally. The desire to do both comes naturally. And then my mom, Jill Cumlin, has been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis since 1980. So it was a combination of becoming a bit more mature and realizing that I can use my love of running and fitness to raise money and awareness for multiple sclerosis.
Your mom was diagnosed in 1980, which, if my math is right, it was before you were born?
Yeah. My mom was diagnosed a year and a half after my older sister was born. And then her symptoms. So multiple sclerosis is a autoimmune disease that attacks the central nervous system, so the brain, the spinal cord, and the optic nerves. And it varies from person to person. So some people can have it very severe. Some people don't have symptoms for a while, and symptoms can be pain, numbness, paralysis, all of the above. So my mom didn't have many symptoms for the first 7 years of her diagnosis, and they progressively have gotten to the point where she is now, where she has trouble walking and poor fine motor skills, and sometimes communication, coordination, balance, all of that can be very difficult. So my parents had decided when she was originally diagnosed, they didn't know as much about the disease as they do now. And my parents decided to go on, you know, just living their life the way that they had planned it and intended. So they had my older brother, they had myself, and then my younger sister. So,
well, and the disease, as you say, has obviously had its effect on her. But as you were growing up and as the disease for her was getting worse, how do you think MS has shaped who you are?
You know, it's interesting because my parents really made our life as normal as possible. And I'm using air quotes there because I do understand that families, you know, each family has their own thing. But they really, you know, we were in sports and they drove us around. And the big thing is we just had to, you know, if we were in a public place and mom started having an episode or something, then we just kind of had to all be in the same boat. And it was difficult at times. I remember being in high school and going prom dressing with my dad, which, you know, I
not what every girl dreams of.
No, especially when my dad took the token, like, oh, you'd look great in a paper bag. And I'm like, thanks, Dad. That doesn't help. So those were the things that I really missed, having that mother-daughter relationship that I even see people, women get to have now. You know, now that I'm 28, I see my friends going out to lunch with their moms and, you know, doing stuff like that. And I can do that with my mom. It's just not the same, especially with her lack of ability to carry on a conversation, forming full sentences and full thoughts, and, you know, memory is an issue too.
Well, and so when did the idea of taking MS on as your own life's work enter the picture? You were a fitness coach on a cruise ship, right?
Yeah. So I was traveling the world and I was getting paid for it. And it was pretty amazing, awesome post-college job. And I was with a company for about a year and a half and just out in the Caribbean. And I don't know, one day I was running on the treadmill and I thought about, I love to travel. I loved the U.S. and I hadn't spent a lot of time traveling in the U.S. So I was kind of thinking about running in U.S. and what should I do? And then I was thinking about running from different cities to see my friends. And it kind of came into this whole maybe I should run across America thing. And that idea stuck in my head for like a day or two just to kind of ponder it. And then when I thought about doing it for my mom, I got super pumped up and really excited and passionate. And I actually quit my job very shortly after that to come home and started MS Run the U.S. and started kind of pursuing that dream to run across the country for multiple sclerosis.
Well, and so how long was that period between the time that this popped into your head while you're on a treadmill and the time that you actually left the West Coast heading for the East Coast?
I would say it was a year and a half. I would say the idea came to me in September, October of 2008. I quit my job in 2009, spent all of 2009 building the nonprofit and getting support and kind of proving that I could run across America before I left. And then I left March 22nd, 2010.
Well, and that seems like it would be a key part of it, not just building the support, but being able to convince people that this is something that you could actually do. Because I would imagine if you're thinking of supporting someone to do this, you don't want them to give up in the middle of Nevada.
Or get injured. Or, I mean, there's a whole variable list of things that could and can go wrong. And even runners with the highest credentials would have a hard time convincing someone they could run across America until they actually did it.
Well, and so how did you do it?
How did I run across
America? Well, no. How did you convince yourself and them and that you could actually do it before you actually did it?
I would say my strongest thing is passion and just getting people to take a chance. Money Mutual was our major support, and we have endorsement with Montel Williams. And so those two together were major financial support, and they really took a big chance with us and said, you know, I think you can get this done. So without that, I think I still would have done it. It would just been on a smaller scale. And, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, I always told myself, I kept repeating myself that I couldn't worry about how I was going to get it done. I just had to, you know, focus on why I was going to do it and what I was going to do, and then the how would develop.
So along the mental lines, I mean, you've been an endurance athlete for a while. You worked as a fitness coach. You still do, I gather. But I would imagine even with that background and even with your mother's life story in the back of your mind, there must have been times in that period between March and September of 2010 where you woke up and you'd already run 800, 1,000 miles, and then the realization hits you that you're not even halfway across the country. How do you motivate yourself to go out and run 25 miles that day?
My mom was the huge motivation. I mean, she's the endurance athlete, really, having that disease for so long. And she is extremely positive and very bright and has just a really strong faith. And quitting wasn't an option because she doesn't get the option to have an off day. And so it really was, you know, stepping outside of my personal feelings or my motivational feelings for the day and saying, okay, mom doesn't get a break, so I don't get a break. And the hard part, too, was building up to the run and then physically running once we had the funding and all of that. It was really focusing on the donations. So once I got to that point, I had to get over a good amount of big hurdles. So I knew that I really wanted it by the time I got there. And so for me, I really was just reminding myself to enjoy the moment because it was going to go by very quickly, no matter how long it felt like at the moment.
And I imagine as you've done this, you have probably heard from a lot of people with the disease or with loved ones with the disease. What goes through your mind when somebody reaches out to you like that?
What I think that MS Run the US provides is more of like an individualized inspiration, motivational platform. And, you know, just an opportunity for people to say, you know what, you can do something about it. And the MS Society has a great, like, do-it-yourself fundraising platform. So anyone, even, you don't have to run across America or participate in the relay to do something for the cause. And I think that's the motivation and the knowledge that you can do something is great.
Ashley Schneider speaking on Lake Effect in 2012. She and her work with MS Run the US are the subject of a feature by Dan Simmons in the May issue of Milwaukee Magazine. You'll find a link to more about it at WUWM.com. And that wraps up the Friday edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Bonnie and I produce Lake Effect along with Joy Powers and Audrey Nowakowski with assistant producer Maddie Andre and intern Zoe Munson. We also get support from the WUWM news team, including Latoya Dennis this week.
Lauren Sickfason is our digital producer. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. And Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music.
Thank you so much for tuning in today. And I sure hope you'll listen again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.